2 years old, riding in the back of the second caravan now, his legs not quite what they used to be. If you can remember your lines in questionable territory, you'll be fine on stage.
Enter Lear, Kirsten said.
20 years earlier, in a life she mostly couldn't remember, she had had a small non-speaking role in a short-lived Toronto production of King Lear. Now she walked in sandals whose soles had been cut from an automobile tire, 3 knives in her belt. She was carrying a paperback version of the play, the stage directions highlighted in yellow.
Mad, she said, continuing, fantastically dressed with wildflowers. But who comes here?
The man learning the part of Edgar said. His name was August, and he had only recently taken to acting. He was the second violin and a secret poet, which is to say, no one in the symphony knew he wrote poetry except Kirsten and the seventh guitar.
The safer sense will ne'er accommodate... Line?
His master thus, Kirsten said.
Cheers! The safer sense will ne'er accommodate his master thus.
The caravans had once been pickup trucks, but now they were pulled by teams of horses on wheels of steel and wood. All of the pieces rendered useless by the end of gasoline had been removed. The engine, the fuel supply system, all the other components that no one under the age of 20 had ever seen in operation, and a bench had been installed on top of each cab for the drivers. The cabs were stripped of everything that added excess weight, but left otherwise intact, with doors that closed and windows of difficult-to-break automobile glass, because when they were traveling through fraught territory, it was nice to have somewhere relatively safe to put the children. The main structures of the caravans had been built in the pickup beds, tarps lashed over frames. The tarps on all three caravans were painted gunmetal gray with the Traveling Symphony, lettered in white on both sides.
No, they cannot touch me for coining, Dieter said over his shoulder.
He was learning the part of Lear, although he wasn't really old enough. Dieter walked a little ahead of the other actors, murmuring to his favorite horse. The horse, Bernstein, was missing half his tail because the first cello had just restrung his bow last week.
Oh, August said, thou side-piercing sight!
You know what's side-piercing, the third trumpet muttered, listening to King Lear 3 times in a row in a heat wave.
You know what's even more side-piercing?
Alexandra was 15, the symphony's youngest actor. They'd found her on the road as a baby.
Traveling for 4 days between towns at the far edge of the territory. What does side-piercing mean?
Olivia asked. She was 6 years old, the daughter of the tuba and an actress named Lynn, and she was riding in the back of the second caravan with Gil and a teddy bear.
We'll be in St. Deborah by the water in a couple of hours, Gil said. There's absolutely nothing to worry about.
There was the flu that exploded like a neutron bomb over the surface of the earth, and the shock of the collapse that followed, the first unspeakable years when everyone was traveling, before everyone caught on that there was no place they could walk to where life continued as it had before, and settled wherever they could, clustered close together for safety in truck stops and former restaurants and old motels. The Traveling Symphony moved between the settlements of the changed world, and had been doing so since 5 years after the collapse, when the conductor had gathered a few of her friends from their military orchestra, left the airbase where they'd been living, and set out into the unknown landscape. By then most people had settled somewhere, because the gasoline had all gone stale by year 3, and you can't keep walking forever. After 6 months of traveling from town to town, the word town used loosely, some of these places were 4 or 5 families living together in a former truck stop, the conductor's orchestra had run into Gil's company of Shakespearean actors, who had all escaped from Chicago together and then worked on a farm for a few years and had been on the road for 3 months, and they'd combined their operations. 20 years after the collapse, they were still in motion,
traveling back and forth along the shores of Lakes Huron and Michigan, west as far as Traverse City, east and north over the 49th parallel to Kincardine. They followed the St. Clair River south to the fishing towns of Marine City and Algonac and back again. This territory was, for the most part, tranquil now. They encountered other travelers only rarely, peddlers mostly, carting miscellanea between towns. The symphony performed music, classical, jazz, orchestral arrangements of pre-collapse pop songs, and Shakespeare. They'd performed more modern plays sometimes in the first few years, but what was startling, what no one would have anticipated, was that audiences seemed to prefer Shakespeare to their other theatrical offerings. "People want what was best about the world," Dieter said. He himself found it difficult to live in the present. He'd played in a punk band in college and longed for the sound of an electric guitar. They were no more than 2 hours out from St. Deborah-by-the-Water now. The Lear rehearsal had dissipated midway through the fourth act, everyone tired, tempers fraying in the heat. They stopped to rest the horses, and Kirsten, who didn't feel like resting, walked a few paces down the road to throw knives at a tree. She threw from 5 paces, from 10, from 20, the satisfying sound of the blades hitting wood. When the symphony began to move again, she climbed up into the back of the second caravan, where Alexandra was resting and mending a costume. "Okay," Alexandra said, picking up an earlier conversation. "So, when you saw the computer screen in Traverse City, what about it?" In Traverse City, the town they'd recently left, an inventor had rigged an electrical system in an attic. It was modest in scope, a stationary bicycle that, when pedaled vigorously, could power a laptop. But the inventor had grander aspirations. The point wasn't actually the electrical system. The point was that he was looking for the Internet. A few of the younger symphony members had felt a little thrill when he'd said this, remembered the stories they'd been told about Wi-Fi and the impossible-to-imagine cloud, wondered if the Internet might still be out there somewhere, invisible pinpricks of light suspended in the air around them. "Was it the way you remembered?" "I don't really remember what computer screens looked like," Kirsten admitted. The second caravan had particularly bad shocks, and riding in it always made her feel like her bones were rattling. "How could you not remember something like that? It was beautiful." "I was 8. Alexandra nodded, unsatisfied, and obviously thinking that if she'd seen a lit-up computer screen when she was 8, she'd have remembered it. In Traverse City, Kirsten had stared at the "This webpage is not available" message on the screen. She didn't seriously believe that the inventor would be able to find the Internet, but she was fascinated by electricity. She harbored visions of a lamp with a pink shade on a side table, a nightlight shaped like a puffy half-moon, a chandelier in a dining room, a brilliant stage. The inventor had pedaled frantically to keep the screen from flickering out, explaining something about satellites. Alexandra had been enraptured, the screen a magical thing with no memories attached. August had stared at the screen with a lost expression. When Kirsten and August broke into abandoned houses, this was a hobby of theirs, tolerated by the conductor because they found useful things sometimes, August always gazed longingly at televisions. As a boy, he'd been quiet and a little shy, obsessed with classical music. He'd had no interest in sports and had never been especially adept at getting along with people, which meant long hours home alone after school in interchangeable U.S. Army base houses while his brothers played baseball and made new friends. One nice thing about television shows was that they were everywhere. Identical programming, whether your parents had been posted to Maryland or California or Texas. He'd spent an enormous amount of time before the collapse watching television, playing the violin, or sometimes doing both simultaneously. And Kirsten could picture this, August at 9, at 10, at 11, pale and scrawny, with dark hair falling in his eyes, and a serious, somewhat fixed expression,
playing a child-sized violin in a wash of electric blue light. When they broke into houses now, August searched for issues of TV Guide, mostly obsolete by the time the pandemic hit, but used by a few people right up to the end. He liked to flip through them later at quiet moments. He claimed he remembered all the shows, starships, sitcom living rooms with enormous sofas, police officers sprinting through the streets of New York, courtrooms with stern-faced judges presiding. He looked for books of poetry, even rarer than TV Guide copies, and studied these in the evenings or while he was walking with the symphony. When Kirsten was in the houses, she searched for celebrity gossip magazines, because once, when she was 16 years old, she'd flipped through a magazine on a dust-blackened side table and found her past. Happy reunion. Arthur Leander picks up son Tyler in LAX. Scruffy Arthur greets 7-year-old Tyler, who lives in Jerusalem with his mother, model actress Elizabeth Colton. The photograph? Arthur, with a 3-day beard, rumpled clothes, a baseball cap, carrying a small boy who beamed up at his father's face while Arthur smiled at the camera. The Georgia flu would arrive in a year.
"I knew him," she'd told August, breathless. "He gave me the comics I showed you."
And August had nodded and asked to see the comics again. There were countless things about the pre-collapse world that Kirsten couldn't remember. Her street address, her mother's face, the TV shows that August never stopped talking about. But she did remember Arthur Leander. And after that first sighting, she went through every magazine she could find in search of him. She collected fragments, stored in a Ziploc bag in her backpack. A picture of Arthur alone on a beach, looking pensive and out of shape. A picture of him with his first wife, Miranda, and then later with his second wife, Elizabeth, a malnourished-looking blonde who didn't smile for cameras. Then with their son, who was about the same age as Kirsten, and later still with a third wife who looked very similar to the second one. "You're like an archaeologist," Charlie said when Kirsten showed off her findings. Charlie had wanted to be an archaeologist when she was little. She was the second cello and one of Kirsten's closest friends. Nothing in Kirsten's collection suggested the Arthur Leander she remembered, but what did she actually remember? Arthur was a fleeting impression of kindness and gray hair, a man who'd once pressed 2 comic books into her hands. "I have a present for you," she was almost certain he'd said. And sometime after this moment, the clearest memory she retained from before the collapse. A stage, a man in a suit talking to her while Arthur lay still on his back with paramedics leaning over him, voices and crying and people gathering, snow somehow falling even though they were indoors, electric light blazing down upon them. Chapter 8. The comics Arthur Leander gave her. 2 issues from a series no one else in the symphony has ever heard of. Doctor 11, Volume 1, Number 1, Station 11, and Doctor 11, Volume 1, Number 2, The Pursuit. By year 20, Kirsten has them memorized. Doctor 11 is a physicist. He lives on a space station, but it's a highly advanced space station that was designed to resemble a small planet. There are deep blue seas and rocky islands linked by bridges, orange and crimson skies with 2 moons on the horizon. The contrabassoon, who prior to the collapse was in the printing business, told Kirsten that the comics had been produced at great expense, all those bright images, that archival paper. So, actually not comics at all in the traditionally mass-produced sense, possibly someone's vanity project. Who would that someone have been? There is no biographical information in either issue, initials in place of the author's name. By M.C. In the inside cover of the first issue, someone has written, "Copy 2 of 10, in pencil. In the second issue, the notation is, "Copy 3 of 10, Is it possible that only 10 copies of each of these books exist in the world? Kirsten's taken care of the comics as best she can, but they're dog-eared now, worn soft at the edges. The first issue falls open to a two-page spread. Dr. Eleven stands on dark rocks overlooking an indigo sea at twilight. Small boats move between islands, wind turbines spinning on the horizon. He holds his fedora in his hand. A small white animal stands by his side. Several of the older symphony members have confirmed that this animal is a dog, but it isn't like any dog Kirsten's ever seen. Its name is Luli. It looks like a cross between a fox and a cloud. A line of text across the bottom of the frame. I stood looking over my damaged home and tried to forget the sweetness of life on Earth. Chapter 9. The symphony arrived in St. Deborah by the water in mid-afternoon. Before the collapse, it had been one of those places that aren't definitely in one town or another. A gas station and a few chain restaurants strung out along a road with a motel and a Walmart. The town marked the southwestern border of the symphony's territory, nothing much beyond it so far as anyone knew. They'd left Charlie and the sixth guitar here 2 years ago, Charlie pregnant with the sixth guitar's baby, arrangements made for them to stay in the former Wendy's by the gas station so she wouldn't have to give birth on the road. Now the symphony came upon a sentry posted at the north end of town, a boy of about 15 sitting under a rainbow beach umbrella by the roadside. "I remember you," he said when they reached him. "You can set up camp at the Walmart." The symphony moved through St. Deborah by the water at a deliberately slow pace, the first trumpet playing a solo from a Vivaldi concerto. But what was strange was that the music drew almost no onlookers as they passed. In Traverse City, the crowd following them down the street upon their arrival had swelled to 100. But here, only 4 or 5 people came to their doors or emerged from around the sides of buildings to stare, unsmiling. And none of them were Charlie or the sixth guitar. The Walmart was at the south end of town, the parking lot wavering in the heat. The symphony parked the caravans near the broken doors, set about the familiar rituals of taking care of the horses, and arguing about which play to perform, or if it should just be music tonight. And still, neither Charlie nor the sixth guitar appeared. "They're probably just off working somewhere," August said. But it seemed to Kirsten that the town was too empty. Mirages were forming in the distance, phantom pools on the road. A man pushing a wheelbarrow seemed to walk on water. A woman carried a bundle of laundry between buildings. Kirsten saw no one else. "I'd suggest Lear for tonight," said Saeed, an actor. "But I don't know that we want to make this place more depressing." "For once, I agree with you," Kirsten said. The other actors were arguing. King Lear, because they'd been rehearsing it all week. August looked nervous. Or Hamlet, because they hadn't performed it in a month. "A Midsummer Night's Dream," Gil said, breaking an impasse. "I believe the evening calls for fairies."
"Is all our company here?"
"You were best to call them generally, man by man, according to the script."
Jackson had been playing bottom for a decade, and was the only one who'd managed to go off book today. Even Kirsten had to look at the text twice. She hadn't played to Tanya in weeks. "This place seems quiet, doesn't it?" Dieter was standing with Kirsten just outside the action of the rehearsal.
"It's creepy. You remember the last time we were here? 10 or 15 kids followed us through town when we arrived and watched the rehearsal."
"You're up," Dieter said.
"I'm not misremembering, am I?"
Kirsten was stepping into the play.
"They crowded all around us."
Dieter frowned, looking down the empty road.
"But room, fairy," said Alexandra, who was playing Puck. "Here comes Oberon."
"And here my mistress," said Lynn, who was playing the fairy. "Would that he were gone."
"Ill met by moonlight, proud Titania."
Saeed carried himself with a regality that Kirsten had fallen in love with once.
Here in this parking lot, in a pressing heat wave, patches of sweat under the arms of his t-shirt, knee-torn jeans, he was perfectly credible as a king.
What, jealous, Oberon?
Kirsten stepped forward as steadily as possible. They'd been a couple for 2 years, until 4 months earlier, when she'd slept with a traveling peddler, more or less out of boredom. And now she had trouble meeting his eyes when they did A Midsummer Night's Dream together.
Fairies, skip hence. I have forsworn his bed and company.
Audible snickering from the sidelines at this. Saeed smirked. Christ, she heard Dieter mutter behind her. Is this really necessary?
Tarry, rash wanton, Saeed said, drawing out the words. Am I not thy lord?
Chapter 10. The problem with the Traveling Symphony was the same problem suffered by every group of people everywhere since before the collapse, undoubtedly since well before the beginning of recorded history. Start, for example, with the third cello. He had been waging a war of attrition with Dieter for some months following a careless remark Dieter had made about the perils of practicing an instrument in dangerous territory, the way the notes can carry for a mile on a clear day. Dieter hadn't noticed. Dieter did, however, harbor considerable resentment toward the second horn because of something she'd once said about his acting. This resentment didn't go unnoticed. The second horn thought he was being petty, but when the second horn was thinking of people she didn't like very much, she ranked him well below the seventh guitar. There weren't actually seven guitars in the symphony, but the guitarists had a tradition of not changing their numbers when another guitarist died or left, so that currently the symphony roster included guitars 4, 7, and 8, with the location of the sixth presently in question, because they were done rehearsing A Midsummer Night's Dream in the Walmart parking lot, they were hanging the Midsummer Night's Dream backdrop between the caravans, they'd been in St. Deborah by the Water for hours now, and why hadn't he come to them? Anyway, the seventh guitar, whose eyesight was so bad that he couldn't do most of the routine tasks that had to be done, the repairs and hunting and such, which would have been fine if he'd found some other way to help out, but he hadn't. He was essentially dead weight as far as the second horn was concerned. The seventh guitar was a nervous person, because he was nearly blind. He'd been able to see reasonably well with an extremely thick pair of glasses, but he'd lost these 6 years ago, and since then he'd lived in a confusing landscape distilled to pure color according to season. Summer mostly green, winter mostly gray and white, in which blurred figures swam into view and then receded before he could figure out who they were. He couldn't tell if his headaches were caused by straining to see or by his anxiety at never being able to see what was coming, but he did know the situation wasn't helped by the first flute, who had a habit of sighing loudly whenever the seventh guitar had to stop rehearsal to ask for clarification on the score that he couldn't see. But the first flute was less irritated by the seventh guitar than she was by the second violin, August, who was forever missing rehearsals, always off somewhere breaking into another house with Kirsten and, until recently, Charlie, like he thought the symphony was a scavenging outfit who played music on the side. If he wanted to join a scavenging outfit, she'd said to the fourth guitar, why didn't he just join a scavenging outfit? You know what the violins are like, the fourth guitar had said. August was annoyed by the third violin, who liked to make insinuating remarks about August and Kirsten, even though they'd only ever been close friends and had, in fact, made a secret pact to this effect, friends forever and nothing else, sworn while drinking with locals one night behind the ruins of a bus depot in some town on the south end of Lake Huron. And the third violin resented the first violin following a long-ago argument about who had used the last of a batch of rosin, while the first violin was chilly to Saeed, because Saeed had rejected her overtures in favor of Kirsten, who expended considerable energy in trying to ignore the viola's habit of dropping random French words into sentences as though anyone else in the entire goddamned symphony spoke French, while the viola harbored secret resentments against someone else, and so on and so forth, etc.,
and this collection of petty jealousies, neuroses, undiagnosed PTSD cases, and simmering resentments lived together, traveled together, rehearsed together, performed together 365 days of the year. Permanent company, permanent tour. But what made it bearable were the friendships, of course, the camaraderie, and the music, and the Shakespeare, the moments of transcendent beauty and joy, when it didn't matter who'd used the last of the rosin on their bow, or who anyone had slept with. Although someone, probably Said, had written, "Sartre, hell is other people," in pen inside one of the caravans, and someone else had scratched out "other people" and substituted "flutes." People left the symphony sometimes, but the ones who stayed understood something that was rarely spoken aloud. Civilization, in year 20, was an archipelago of small towns. These towns had fought off ferals, buried their neighbors, lived and died and suffered together in the blood-drenched years just after the collapse, survived against unspeakable odds, and then only by holding together into the calm, and these places didn't go out of their way to welcome outsiders. "Small towns weren't even easy before," August said once at 3 in the morning, the one time Kirsten remembered talking about this with anyone, in the cold of a spring night near the town of New Phoenix. She was 15 at the time, which made August 18, and she'd only been with the symphony for a year. In those days, she had considerable trouble sleeping, and often sat up with the night watch. August remembered his pre-pandemic life as an endless sequence of kids who'd looked him over and uttered variations on, "You're not from around here, are you?" in various accents, these encounters interspersed with moving trucks. If it was hard to break into new places then, in that ludicrously easy world where food was on shelves in supermarkets and travel was as easy as taking a seat in a gasoline-powered machine and water came out of taps, it was several orders of magnitude more difficult now. The symphony was insufferable. Hell was other flutes, or other people, or whoever had used the last of the rosin, or whoever missed the most rehearsals. But the truth was that the symphony was their only home. At the end of the Midsummer Night's Dream rehearsal, Kirsten stood by the caravans with the palms of her hands pressed hard to her forehead, trying to will away a headache. "You okay?" August asked. "Hell is other actors," Kirsten said. "Also, ex-boyfriends. Stick to musicians. I think we're generally saner. I'm going to take a walk and see if I can find Charlie. I'd come with you, but I'm on dinner duty." "I don't mind going alone," she said. A late afternoon torpor had fallen over the town, the light thickening and shadows extending over the road. The road was disintegrating here as everywhere, deep fissures and potholes holding gardens of weeds. There were wildflowers along the vegetable patches at the edge of the pavement, Queen Anne's lace whispering against Kirsten's outstretched hand. She passed by the Motor Lodge, where the oldest families in town lived, laundry flapping in the breeze, doors open on motel rooms, a little boy playing with a toy car between the tomato plants in the vegetable garden. The pleasure of being alone for once, away from the clamor of the symphony. It was possible to look up at the McDonald's sign and fleetingly imagine, by keeping her gaze directed upward so that there was only the sign and the sky, that this was still the former world, and she could stop in for a burger. The last time she'd been here, the IHOP had housed 3 or 4 families. She was surprised to see that it had been boarded up, a plank hammered across the door with an inscrutable symbol spray-painted in silver, something like a lowercase T with an extra line toward the bottom. 2 years ago, she'd been followed around town by a flock of children, but now she saw only 2, the boy with the toy car, and a girl of 11 or so who watched her from a doorway. A man with a gun and reflective sunglasses was standing guard at the gas station, whose windows were blocked by curtains that had once been flowered sheets. A young and very pregnant woman sunbathed on a lounge chair by the gas pumps, her eyes closed. The presence of an armed guard in the middle of town suggested that the place was unsafe. Had they recently been raided? But surely not as unsafe as all that, if a pregnant woman was sunbathing in the open. It didn't quite make sense. The McDonald's had housed two families, but where had they gone? Now a board had been nailed across the door, spray-painted with that same odd symbol. The Wendy's was a low, square building with the look of having been slapped together from a kit in an architecturally careless era, but it had a beautiful front door. It was a replacement, solid wood, and someone had taken the trouble to carve a row of flowers alongside the carved handle. Kirsten ran her fingertips over the wooden petals before she knocked. How many times had she imagined this moment, over 2 years of traveling apart from her friend? Knocking on the flowered door, Charlie answering with a baby in her arms, tears and laughter, the sixth guitar grinning beside her. "I have missed you so much." But the woman who answered the door was unfamiliar. "Good afternoon," Kirsten said. "I'm looking for Charlie." "I'm sorry, who?" The woman's tone wasn't unfriendly, but there was no recognition in her eyes. She was about Kirsten's age, or a little younger, and it seemed to Kirsten that she wasn't well. She was very pale and too thin, black circles under her eyes. "Charlie? Charlotte Harrison. She was here about 2 years ago."
"Here in the Wendy's?"
"Yes."
"Oh, Charlie, where are you?"
"She's a friend of mine. A cellist? She was here with her husband, the sixth... Her husband, Jeremy. She was pregnant."
"I've only been here a year, but maybe someone else here would know. Would you like to come in?"
Kirsten stepped into an airless corridor. It opened into a common room at the back of the building, where once there'd been an industrial kitchen. She saw a cornfield through the open back door, stalks swaying for a dozen yards or so before the wall of the forest. An older woman sat in a chair by the doorway, knitting. Kirsten recognized the local midwife.
"Maria," she said.
Maria was backlit by the open door behind her. It was impossible to see the expression on her face when she looked up.
"You're with the symphony," she said. "I remember you."
"I'm looking for Charlie and Jeremy."
"I'm sorry. They left town."
"Left? Why would they leave? Where did they go?"
The midwife glanced at the woman who'd shown Kirsten in. The woman looked at the floor. Neither spoke.
"At least tell me when," Kirsten said. "How long have they been gone?"
"A little more than a year."
"Did she have her baby?"
"A little girl, Annabelle. Perfectly healthy."
"And is that all you'll tell me?"
Kirsten was entertaining a pleasant fantasy of holding a knife to the midwife's throat.
"Alyssa," Maria said to the other woman, "you look so pale, darling. Why don't you go lie down?"
Alyssa disappeared through a curtained doorway into another room. The midwife stood quickly.
"Your friend rejected the prophet's advances," she whispered, close to Kirsten's ear. "They had to leave town. Stop asking questions and tell your people to leave here as quickly as possible."
She settled back into her chair and picked up her knitting.
"Thank you for stopping by," she said in a voice loud enough to be heard in the next room. "Is the symphony performing tonight?"
"A Midsummer Night's Dream, with orchestral accompaniment."
Kirsten was having trouble keeping her voice steady. That after 2 years the symphony might arrive in St. Deborah by the Water to find that Charlie and Jeremy had already left was a possibility that hadn't occurred to her.
"This town seems different from when we were here last," she said.
"Oh," the midwife said brightly, "it is. It's completely different."
Kirsten stepped outside and the door closed behind her. The girl she'd noticed in a doorway earlier had followed her here and was standing across the road, watching. Kirsten nodded to her. The girl nodded back. A serious child, unkempt in a way that suggested neglect, her hair tangled, her t-shirt collar torn. Kirsten wanted to call out to her, to ask if she knew where Charlie and Jeremy had gone, but something in the girl's stare unnerved her. Had someone told the girl to watch her? Kirsten turned away to continue down the road, wandering with studied casualness and trying to convey the impression of being interested only in the late afternoon light, the wildflowers, the dragonflies gliding on currents of air. When she glanced over her shoulder, the girl was trailing behind her at some distance. 2 years ago, she'd done this walk with Charlie, both of them delaying the inevitable in the final hours before the symphony left. "These 2 years will go quickly," Charlie had said, and they had gone quickly when Kirsten considered it, up to Kincardine, back down the coastline and down the St. Clair River, winter in one of the St. Clair fishing towns, performances of Hamlet and Lear in the town hall, which had previously been a high school gymnasium, The Winter's Tale, Romeo and Juliet, the musicians performing almost every night, then A Midsummer Night's Dream when the weather grew warmer. An illness that passed through the symphony in spring, a high fever and vomiting. Half the symphony got sick, but everyone recovered, except the third guitar, a grave by the roadside outside of New Phoenix.
"And we continued onward, Charlie, like always, all those months, and always I thought of you here in this town."
There was someone on the road ahead, walking quickly to meet her. The sun was skimming the tops of the trees now, the road in shadow, and it was a moment before she recognized Dieter. "We should be getting back," she said. "I have to show you something first. You'll want to see this."
"What is it?"
She didn't like his tone. Something had rattled him. She told him what the midwife had said while they walked. He frowned. "She said they'd left? Are you sure that's what she said?"
"Of course I'm sure. Why?"
At the northern edge of town, a new building had been underway at the very end. The foundation poured just before the Georgia flu arrived. It was a concrete pad, bristling with metal bars, overgrown now with vines. Dieter stepped off the road and led her down a path behind it. All towns have graveyards, and St. Deborah-by-the-Waters had grown considerably since she'd wandered here 2 years ago with Charlie. There were perhaps 300 graves, spaced in neat rows between the abandoned foundation and the forest. In the newest section, freshly painted markers blazed white in the grass. She saw the names at some distance.
"No," she said. "Oh, no, please."
"It's not them," Dieter said. "I have to show you this, but it isn't them." Three markers in a row in the afternoon shadows, names painted neatly in black. Charlie Harrison, Jeremy Lung, Annabelle, infant. All three with the same date, July 20th, year 19. "It's not them," Dieter said again. "Look at the ground. No one's buried under those markers." The horror of seeing their names there. She was weakened by the sight. But he was right, she realized. The earliest markers at the far end of the graveyard were unmistakably planted above graves, the dirt mounded. This pattern continued through to a cluster of 30 graves from a year and a half ago, the dates of death within a 2-week span. An illness, obviously, something that spread fast and vicious in the winter cold. But after this, the irregularities began. About half of the graves following the winter illness looked like graves, while the others, Charlie's and Jeremy's and their babies among them, were markers driven into perfectly flat and undisturbed earth.
"It doesn't make sense," she said.
"We could ask your shadow." The girl who'd followed Kirsten through town was standing at the edge of the graveyard by the foundation, watching them.
"You,"
Kirsten said. The girl stepped back.
"Did you know Charlie and Jeremy?"
The girl glanced over her shoulder. When she returned her gaze to Kirsten and Dieter, her nod was barely perceptible.
"Are they..."
Kirsten gestured toward the graves.
"They left,"
the girl said very quietly.
"It speaks," Dieter said.
"When did they..."
But the girl's nerve failed her before Kirsten could finish the question. She darted out of sight behind the foundation, and Kirsten heard her footsteps on the road. Kirsten was left alone with Dieter, with the graves, and the forest. They looked at one another, but there was nothing to say.
A short time after they returned to the Walmart, the Tuba returned to camp with his own report. He'd tracked down an acquaintance who lived in the motel. There'd been an epidemic, the man had told him. 30 people had died incandescent with fever, including the mayor. After this, a change in management, but the Tuba's acquaintance had declined to elaborate on what he meant by this. He did say that 20 families had left since then, including Charlie and the 6th guitar and their baby. He said no one knew where they'd gone, and he'd told the Tuba it was best not to ask. A change in management? The conductor said. How corporate of them. They'd discussed the grave markers at some length. What did the graves mark, if not deaths? Did the markers await a future event? I told you, Kirsten said. The midwife said there was a prophet.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Saeed was unpacking a crate of candles without looking at anyone. The 6th guitar was one of his closest friends.
Just what every town needs.
Someone must know where they went, the conductor said. They must have told someone. Doesn't anyone else have friends here? I knew a guy who lived in the IHOP, the 3rd cello said. But I checked earlier and it was boarded up, and then someone in the motor lodge said he'd left town last year. No one would tell me where Charlie and Jeremy went. No one tells you anything here. Kirsten wanted to cry, but instead she stared at the pavement, pushing a pebble back and forth with her foot. How could we have left them here? Lynn shook out her fairy costume, a silver cocktail dress that shimmered like the scales of a fish, and a cloud of dust rose into the air. Graves, she said. I can't even begin to...
Not graves, Dieter said. Grave markers. Towns change.
Gil leaned on his cane by the 3rd caravan, gazing at the buildings and gardens of St. Deborah by the water, at the haze of wildflowers along the edges of the road. The McDonald's sign caught the last of the sunlight.
We couldn't have predicted.
There could be an explanation, the 3rd cello said, doubtful. They could have left and, I don't know, someone thought they were dead? There's a prophet, Kirsten said. There are grave markers with their names on them. The midwife said I should stop asking questions and that we should leave quickly. Did I mention that?
Did we not acknowledge you loudly enough the first 6 times you mentioned it? Saeed asked.
The conductor sighed.
We can't leave till we know more, she said. Let's get on with the evening, and we'll make inquiries after the show.
The caravans were parked end to end, the Midsummer Night's Dream backdrop, sewn together sheets, grimy now from years of travel, painted with a forest scene, hung on them. Alexandra and Olivia had gathered branches and flowers to complete the effect, and 100 candles marked the edges of the stage.
I was talking to our fearless leader, August said to Kirsten later, between tuning his instrument and going to join the rest of the string section, and she thinks Charlie and the 6th guitar must have gone south down the lakeshore.
Why south?
Because west's the water, and they didn't go north. We would have run into them on the road.
The sun was setting, the citizens of St. Deborah by the water gathering for the performance. Far fewer of them now than there had been, no more than 30 in 2 grim-faced rows on the grit of the former parking lot. A wolfish gray dog lay on its side at the end of the front row, its tongue lolling. The girl who'd followed Kirsten was nowhere in sight.
Is there anything to the south, though?
August shrugged.
It's a lot of coastline, he said. There's got to be something between here and Chicago, wouldn't you think?
They could have gone inland.
It's possible, but they know we never go into the interior. They'd only go inland if they didn't want to see us again, and why would they...
He shook his head. None of it made sense.
They had a girl, Kirsten said. Annabelle.
That was Charlie's sister's name.
Places,
the conductor said, and August left to join the strings. Chapter 11.
What was lost in the collapse?
Almost everything. Almost everyone, but there is still such beauty.
Twilight in the Altered World, a performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream in a parking lot in the mysteriously named town of St. Deborah-by-the-Water, Lake Michigan, shining a half-mile away. Kirsten as Titania, a crown of flowers on her close-cropped hair, the jagged scar on her cheekbone half-erased by candlelight. The audience is silent. Saeed, circling her in a tuxedo that Kirsten found in a dead man's closet near the town of East Jordan. Tarry, rash wanton. Am I not thy lord? Then I must be thy lady. Lines of a play written in 1594, the year London's theaters reopened after two seasons of plague, or written possibly a year later, in 1595, a year before the death of Shakespeare's only son. Some centuries later, on a distant continent, Kirsten moves across the stage in a cloud of painted fabric, half in rage, half in love. She wears a wedding dress that she scavenged from a house near New Petoskey, the chiffon and silk streaked with shades of blue from a child's watercolor kit. But with thy brawls, she continues, thou hast disturbed our sport. She never feels more alive than at these moments. When on stage, she fears nothing. Therefore the winds, piping to us in vain as in revenge, have sucked up from the sea contagious fogs. Pestilential, a note in the text explains, next to the word contagious, in Kirsten's favorite of the three versions of the text that the symphony carries. Shakespeare was the third born to his parents, but the first to survive infancy. Four of his siblings died young. His son, Hamnet, died at 11 and left behind a twin. Plague closed the theaters again and again, death flickering over the landscape. And now in a twilight once more lit by candles, the age of electricity having come and gone, Titania turns to face her fairy king. Therefore the moon, the governess of floods, pale in her anger, washes all the air that rheumatic diseases do abound. Oberon watches her with his entourage of fairies. Titania speaks as if to herself now, Oberon forgotten. Her voice carries high and clear over the silent audience, over the string section waiting for their cue on stage left. And through this distemperature, we see the seasons alter. All three caravans of the Traveling Symphony are labeled as such, the Traveling Symphony, lettered in white on both sides. But the lead caravan carries an additional line of text. Because survival is insufficient. Chapter 12. The audience rose for a standing ovation. Kirsten stood in the state of suspension that always came over her at the end of performances, a sense of having flown very high and landed incompletely, her soul pulling upward out of her chest. A man in the front row had tears in his eyes. In the back row, another man whom she'd noticed earlier, he alone had sat on a chair, the chair carried up from the gas station by a woman, stepped forward and raised his hands over his head as he passed through the front row. The applause faded. "My people," he said, "please be seated." He was tall, in his late 20s or early 30s, with blonde hair to his shoulders and a beard. He stepped over the half-circle of candles to stand among the actors. The dog, who'd been lying by the front row, sat up at attention. "What a delight," he said. "What a marvelous spectacle." There was something almost familiar in his face, but Kirsten couldn't place him. Saeed was frowning. "Thank you," the man said to the actors and musicians. "Let us all thank the Traveling Symphony for this beautiful respite from our daily cares." He was smiling at each of them in turn. The audience applauded again, on cue, but quieter now. "We are blessed," he said, and as he raised his hands, the applause stopped at once. The prophet. "We are blessed to have these musicians and actors in our midst today.
Something in his tone made Kirsten want to run, a suggestion of a trap door waiting under every word.
"We have been blessed," he said, "in so many ways, have we not? We are blessed most of all in being alive today. We must ask ourselves, why? Why were we spared?"
He was silent for a moment, scanning the symphony and the assembled crowd, but no one responded.
"I submit," the prophet said, "that everything that has ever happened on this earth has happened for a reason."
The conductor was standing by the string section, her hands clasped behind her back. She was very still.
"My people," the prophet said, "earlier in the day I was contemplating the flu, the great pandemic, and let me ask you this. Have you considered the perfection of the virus?"
A ripple of murmurs and gasps moved through the audience, but the prophet raised a hand and they fell silent.
"Consider," he said, "those of you who remember the world before the Georgia flu, consider the iterations of the illness that preceded it, those trifling outbreaks against which we were immunized as children, the flus of the past." "There was the outbreak of 1918, my people, the timing obvious, divine punishment for the waste and slaughter of the First World War. But then, in the decades that followed, the flus came every season. But these were weak, inefficient viruses that struck down only the very old, the very young, and the very sick. And then came a virus like an avenging angel, unsurvivable, a microbe that reduced the population of the fallen world by what?
There were no more statisticians by then, my angels, but shall we say 99.99%? 1 person remaining out of every 250, 300?
I submit, my beloved people, that such a perfect agent of death could only be divine, for we have read of such a cleansing of the earth, have we not?
Kirsten met Dieter's gaze across the stage. He'd played Theseus. He fiddled nervously with the cufflinks on his shirt.
"The flu," the prophet said, "the great cleansing that we suffered 20 years ago, that flu was our flood. The light we carry within us is the ark that carried Noah and his people over the face of the terrible waters, and I submit that we were saved,"
his voice was rising, "not only to bring the light, to spread the light, but to be the light.
We were saved because we are the light. We are the pure."
Sweat ran down Kirsten's back under the silk of the dress. The dress, she noted absently, didn't smell very good. When had she last washed it? The prophet was still talking about faith and light and destiny, divine plans revealed to him in dreams, the preparations they must make for the end of the world.
"For it has been revealed to me that the plague of 20 years ago was just the beginning, my angels, only an initial culling of the impure. That last year's pestilence was but further preview, and there will be more cullings, far more cullings to come."
And when his sermon was over, he went to the conductor and spoke softly to her. She said something in response, and he stepped back with a laugh.
"I wouldn't know," he said. "People come and go."
"Do they?" the conductor said. "Are there other towns nearby, perhaps down the coast, where people typically travel?"
"There's no town nearby," he said. "But everyone..."
He looked over his shoulder at the silent crowd, smiling at them, and spoke loudly enough for everyone to hear him.
"Everyone here, of course, is free to go as they please."
"Naturally," the conductor said. "I wouldn't have expected otherwise. It's just that we wouldn't have expected them to set off on their own, given that they knew we were coming back for them." The prophet nodded. Kirsten edged closer to eavesdrop more effectively. The other actors were receding quietly from the stage.
"My people and I,"
he said, when we speak of the light, we speak of order. This is a place of order. People with chaos in their hearts cannot abide here. If you'll forgive me for prying, though, I have to ask about the markers in the graveyard. It's not an unreasonable question, the prophet said. You've been on the road for some time, have you not? Yes. Your symphony was on the road in the beginning? Close to it, the conductor said. Year 5. And you? The prophet turned suddenly to Kirsten. I walked for all of year 1. Although she felt dishonest claiming this, given that she had no memory whatsoever of that first year. If you've been on the road for that long, the prophet said, if you've wandered all your life, as I have, through the terrible chaos, if you remember, as I do, everything you've ever seen, then you know there's more than one way to die. Oh, I've seen multiple ways, the conductor said, and Kirsten saw that she was remaining calm with some difficulty. Actually, everything from drowning to decapitation to fever, but none of those ways would account for... You misunderstand me, the prophet said. I'm not speaking of the tedious variations on physical death. There's the death of the body, and there's the death of the soul. I saw my mother die twice. When the fallen slink away without permission, he said, we hold funerals for them and erect markers in the graveyard because, to us, they are dead. He glanced over his shoulder at Alexandra collecting flowers from the stage and spoke into the conductor's ear. The conductor stepped back. Absolutely not, she said. It's out of the question. The prophet stared at her for a moment before he turned away. He murmured something to a man in the front row, the archer who'd been guarding the gas station that morning, and they walked together away from the Walmart. Luli? The prophet called over his shoulder, and the dog trotted after him. The audience was dispersing now, and within minutes the symphony was alone in the parking lot. It was the first time in memory that no one from the audience had lingered to speak with the symphony after a performance. Quickly, the conductor said, harness the horses.
I thought we were staying a few days, Alexandra said, a little whiny.
It's a doomsday cult. The clarinet was unclipping the Midsummer Night's Dream backdrop. Weren't you listening?
But the last time we came here...
This isn't the town it was the last time we were here. The painted forest collapsed into folds and fell soundlessly to the pavement. This is one of those places where you don't notice everyone's dropping dead around you till you've already drunk the poisoned wine.
Kirsten knelt to help the clarinet roll the fabric.
You should maybe wash that dress, the clarinet said. He's gone back into the gas station, Saeed said. There were armed guards posted on either side of the gas station door now, indistinct in the twilight. A cooking fire flared by the motel. The symphony was on their way within minutes, departing down a back road behind the Walmart that took them away from the center of town. A small fire flickered by the roadside ahead. They found a boy there, a sentry, roasting something that might have been a squirrel at the end of a stick. Most towns had sentries with whistles at the obvious points of entry, the idea being that it was nice to have a little warning if marauders were coming through. But the boy's youth and inattention suggested that this wasn't considered an especially dangerous post. He stood as they approached, holding his dinner away from the flames.
You have permission to leave? He called out.
The conductor motioned to the first flute, who was driving the lead caravan, keep moving, and went to speak with the boy. Good evening, she said. Kirsten stopped walking and lingered a few feet away, listening. What's your name? He asked, suspicious. People call me the conductor. And that's your name? It's the only name I use. Is that dinner?
Did you get permission to leave?
The last time we were here, she said, no permission was required. It's different now. The boy's voice hadn't broken yet. He sounded very young. What if we didn't have permission?
Well, the boy said, When people leave without permission, we have funerals for them.
What happens when they come back?
If we've already had a funeral, the boy said, but seemed unable to finish the sentence.
This place, the fourth guitar muttered. This goddamned hellhole.